Last week, we started out on a journey taking the month of January to take a look at something I'm just kind of call Disciples Together. Just kind of the thought of some of the reading and things that I've been exposed to, the thought, you know, in Texas, we like things like the Lone Ranger and we like our independence, but just some thoughts of some Christians about how disciples working together can make a difference, a tremendous difference, not only in our own lives, but in the lives of others and reaching out. Part of the reason for this series has been a meeting that we had back in November at Coker's Barbecue with the folks from Mission Alive. Now, Mission Alive is a group that I had first heard about from Terry back before we started coming to CCC more than 10 years ago, and the kind of things that they were trying to do to help churches be more evangelistic and meet the needs of those in their communities. About a year ago, I was at a fundraising dinner for Mission Alive, and Royce Money was the guest speaker. He, many of you probably know, was the president of ACU for a couple of decades, I think, and is now, I think, the chancellor there. But it's just, again, just the thought of me, how mainstream they are, that they're not being a Mission Alive, not being kind of a weird group that people look at with a lot of heavy doubt and curiosity about what they're doing, but a group that's doing some positive things that people are really embracing. And another reason that I was particularly myself interested in Mission Alive is because of a partnership that they have with another group called 3DM. And they told me what 3DM stood for once, and I've forgotten. So anyway, we'll go on. But last week, it was I just wanted to summarize a little because it's been a week, and of course, we had a lot of people still out of town, as we may today, too. But it was kind of, to me, kind of a report. It was kind of like having Jessica here to talk about what was going on in the Czech Republic, or maybe having Sarah here to talk about amazing things that God has done there in the Bronx. And I just shared some things last week, and briefly I'm going to review that. The story that I share with you about Mike Breen. Mike was what they called the rector. That's an Anglican term for the lead clergy guy over a church. He became the rector of the church in this picture here in 1994. And you may recall that he was following the steps of a fellow that had a pretty dynamic ministry, although he had incorporated a whole lot of New Age kind of stuff into Christianity. And you remember that he fell from grace because of a lot of sexual scandals and things that were going on, and the church just kind of splintered and fell apart. And the picture of the church there, you may recall, is the one that the news would always run a picture of that church to talk about what Christians do that's not right. And so he's the rector of a church that had all that kind of bad publicity. But one thing that they had really started doing right from the start was they realized they were in a place where the average church size in England was about 2 dozen people, that they have these huge cathedrals with not very many people sitting in them. And so they really started trying to reach out and do things in the community, reach out to folks there. And eventually they started meeting in a gym. But there was just a kind of a lot of conflicts and interruptions and that kind of thing. And you may remember that there was a nightclub that had been really popular in the past. The Rolling Stones would play there. But this nightclub kind of went bankrupt, and the church there had a chance to get into it, and it was in the downtown. And I thought that'd be a great opportunity. And so they moved in there, and they continued to focus somewhat on these small groups out in the community. But then you may recall Mike Breen said that he felt like God was telling him that they needed to get ready to do it without the building. And so they concentrated even harder on these missional communities that might meet just anywhere. They might meet in a bar. They might meet in Coker's Barbecue. They might meet just about anywhere. And so it was almost a year to the day that the fire department condemned the building and told them that they couldn't meet there anymore. And so they worked really hard then pushing what they called missional communities. And when they said that, a missional community, they saw it as an extended family. They saw it as something like the Greek word oikos for household. They saw it as a way for Christians to band together and support each other, but also to reach out into the community, to have a way to think about that. One thing that they stress, to get a little ahead of some future talks, they stress finding a person of peace. You may recall when Jesus sent out the 12, and again when he sent out the 72, that he told them to go into a community and look for someone that would welcome them. And they called that a person of peace. And they would say, God's peace be upon you. They didn't move from house to house, staying with different people. If they couldn't find anyone that would accept them, they'd shake the dust off their feet and move on. But if they found someone who was a person of peace, they stayed with them. And so these mystical communities are families. They do a lot of things to be with people, but they're constantly looking for a person of what they call a person of peace that might give them an inroad into to that community. So they consider them extended families. They think of it as about 20 to 50 adults plus kids. They talk about different kinds of space, personal space, like you might have up to a dozen people, like maybe a lot of times in a small group. They talk about public space, which is like 75 people or more, like you might find at the Cowboys game today, like you might find in churches coming together. But there's kind of an intermediate space that they call social space that's about this group, an area where people can feel a little anonymous as they get involved, but can also feel like they can be a part of it. And so that's the kind of the size group that they worked on. Anyway, this church was homeless after they lost the Roxy for about a year. They were able to rent space occasionally where they could all come together. He said like about every 6 weeks they found some place that they could all meet. And then finally they got a warehouse where they could get together, all of the churches, and meet. But they continued. In fact, the number of missional communities, they said, doubled in that year when they didn't have a building. So that by the year 2000, they said that there was a survey group that said that they had become the largest church in England and probably the largest church in all of Europe. So they said in a place where a church of 39 was considered to be large, they had thousands. I thought it was so interesting that this is basically in the decade leading up to the beginning of CCC, and just see the kind of some amazing things they did. I first learned of them through some books I just happened upon on Amazon. One of them was called Leading a Missional Community, and I shared some of the quotes that I shared last week were from my reading of this book. It was published in 2013, and so I think I must have found it when it was, you know, freshly out and was getting a lot of press, so to speak. A little over a year ago in November, I went to a seminar near Houston. It was at a Lutheran church, and it was really interesting to me that there were all different kinds of Christian groups that were there, and it really struck me that, you know, when I hear of a kind of one of those dogmatic groups that's pulling people apart, they're usually centered on some kind of one sector, and these guys are just all over. And finding people that are interested in them. One of the quotes that I heard there, I shared last week, they said, if God is shaking it, why are we protecting it? And I thought about the message that so many of us felt hearing what was going on at this place, that God was shaking something, and we weren't sure what he wanted us to do, but we knew that he wanted to get our attention, and we needed to start opening our eyes to kind of see what he might be saying and praying about that. A third book that I read was called Building a Discipling Culture. The one I had was a 2011 edition. They've just come out with a new one. But this is actually a book that our small group had started reading on some time ago, and then we kind of got more involved with UT Arlington. But these were some of the books that we were looking at. And some of the things, just in conclusion from last week, that really impressed me about this group was they talked about having low control and high accountability. And I like that because so many groups just want to control everything. They talked about how they didn't want clones. They wanted everybody to decide that we're going to go and be just like them. But they wanted people to get to the point where we could continue to look and see what is God saying right now, what would God want now, not trying to be like some other super church, perhaps. They talked about how children were an integral part of what they were doing, not a distraction, not something that just had to be dealt with. They talked about evangelism being something that was among the common people, not just something where if we can just get folks up here, then maybe the preacher can talk to them, but something where all of us could be a part of. And I liked hearing all those things. Today, I want to talk about an emphasis that they have that I really like too. And the passage that I'd like to start with today really is this one in Matthew 11, where Jesus says, "Come to me, all you who are weak and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." Certainly a very beautiful passage. And one of the things that I pull this up just to point out something that they really stress in their work is that Jesus offers what they call a kind of two things. He offers an invitation. And you see it over and over again. There's so many times that Jesus says, come. He's and talking to people. And here's one where he says that very thing, come to me. He says, take my yoke. Be with me. Be a part of me. Walk with me. So there's a strong invitation. There's this invitation to belong. There's this call to a relationship. And at the same time, there's a challenge. There's a challenge to become something. There's a challenge to have a responsibility in that relationship. And so, you know, we're not from a farming culture here today, but I think most of us have heard stories, people talking about this yoke, that if you took a very young ox and tried to tie it to a plow and get it to pull, that it would burn up all its energy really quickly because it wouldn't have the sense about how do you make yourself, give yourself the stamina to last for a 12-hour day, a 10-hour day of pulling this plow. And so what they would do is they would yoke it to an older and experienced yoke ox. And so the younger ox then might try to get ahead, but he would burn himself out going, this is a waste of my time. And so he would start falling in stride with the older oxen, and together they could plow the field, and the younger oxen then would learn this rhythm and would learn how to make himself endure and how to make it work. And so here Jesus is saying that he wants to be that. He wants to have that yoke, and so I want you to walk with me. I want you to learn the way I do things, and you're going to grow that way. It's interesting, this phrase, the first line, oh, you are weak and burdened. In the Message, Peterson says, all of you who are burned out on religion. And I remember the first time I read him, it was one of the many times I've read Peterson and said, well, he missed that one. And then I went to look, and in this word burdened here is only used one other time in the New Testament, and it's when Jesus is speaking to the Pharisees, and he says, woe to you, because you load people up with burdens, and then you won't lift a finger to help them. And so Jesus is here really making a contrast between himself and the religious leaders of the day who would burden you like a pack animal with tons of stuff, and you couldn't hold the weight, you couldn't succeed. And Jesus says, I'm not like them. Cast that sucker off and take my yoke instead. And so we have this sense then that Jesus wants to give us this relationship, and he wants to, through that, enable us to change and be different. And so Breen and others have talked then about this idea of invitation and challenge, or we might word it as relationship and responsibility, kind of like in our families, that we have this strong relationship, but there's also responsibility, there's also expectations that we have in our family together and as we raise children and those kinds of things. Another way might be to call it belonging and becoming. And so they were stressing those. So maybe just to focus on that just a little bit, this idea of invitation, challenge, some other passages. Right after Jesus' temptation in the wilderness, he starts healing people and folks are coming to him, and one of the very first things he does, of course, is choose his 12 apostles. And what he tells Peter and Andrew as he gets them out of the boat there is, come and follow me, and I will make you fishers of men. So there's that invitation. You've got to be with me. But there's also that challenge that you're going to be something different than you've ever been before. There's not going to be fishing for fish anymore. It's something that's going to be even greater. Another one, the Sermon on the Mount that follows right after that, there's a lot of statements like this, but here's one. Love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. So again, there's that relationship, but it's if you're a son of your Father in heaven, you live differently. This is how you live. The time when Jesus' family comes to collect him, you remember, because they think he's crazy? Your mother and brothers are outside to get you. And he says, whoever does the will of my Father in heaven is my brother and sister and mother. Again, here's this relationship with Jesus, but it's that people who are with me, those are the ones that are doing the will of my Father. They have a different perspective, a different thing that guides them in their walk. All the way down through Matthew, and then at the very end, the last couple of verses there, go and make disciples of all nations, teaching them to obey everything I've commanded you, and surely I'm with you to the very end of the age. Over and over again, there's that invitation to be with me. I'm always there with you. I'm never going to leave you. and at the same time this challenge. You're going to make disciples of the nations because that's who we are. That's what we do. And so there, maybe we can think of it as kind of a scale. On the one hand, we might have a scale of invitation. Low invitation to high. When I think about invitation, maybe one thing I think of is Zacchaeus. You remember the story of Zacchaeus, that he didn't think Jesus would want to have anything to do with a person like him. So he climbed up in a tree because he just wanted to see the guy, right? He just wanted to dream. You know, if only I were someone different. But for now, I'm going to climb up in this tree. But if you recall, as Jesus was walking by, he saw Zacchaeus and he says, "Hey, Zacchaeus, come down. I'm eating with you today." So, I mean, the invitation went from, "I've got no hope with Jesus," to this, "Jesus at my house today." You know, the excitement of that. And you recall how that invitation changed his life, turned him completely upside down, gave him new everything. And you see a lot of this then among the sinners. Jesus was a friend of sinners. And you see so many stories repeated of how they, you know, the Pharisees looked down their noses at Jesus because he had this high invitation with lost people, with sinners. Well, you know, the famous statement, the healthy don't need a doctor. I've come to call the sick. And so this high invitation. And another scale then that we've talked about is a scale that is of challenge. That's maybe a scale from very low challenge to very high challenge. When I think about the idea of a challenge, I think about some things that Jesus said, for example, about bearing fruit. He says, "Everyone who bears fruit, that branch, I will prune it, and it's going to do even more." So there was this start doing something, and I'm going to keep giving you more things that you're going to do, and I'm going to prune that, and you're going to do more and more. Or I think about Hebrews where it says, you know, don't fret just because God's disciplining you, because that's what God does to people that he loves, right? Things happen to us, and we have a new thing that we have to depend on him on, a new thing that he's going to teach us through all of that. And so they kind of have these two scales that interplay just a bit. And so I just like to think about, maybe what does it mean to be in this bottom left quadrant, this idea of not feeling much invitation with Jesus and not feeling much challenge? And I think as a whole, churches are not in that area. That's more folks that aren't interested in Jesus. I think about the Pharisees, you recall. They rejected Jesus. They didn't want to have anything to do with him. I remember, and you'll recall, in his final week, he tells a parable about this fellow who's going off. It's a parable of the 10 minas. This fellow, he's going off to be made king. And so before he leaves, he gives a mina to each of 10 servants and asks them to put it to work while he's gone. And as soon as he leaves, a delegation follows him because they don't want him to be king, right? And they argue for him not to be king. And it sounds just like the Pharisees, right? It's like, we don't know who this Jesus is. We don't want him. He's not our guy, okay? So when this guy comes back after having been made king, he starts calling people in, his servants, who he's given a mina to. And he gets down to the fellow you recall where the fellow says, "I knew how tough you were, and I was just scared to death I might lose this mina. So I wrapped it in a piece of cloth and hid it to make sure no one got it. And so here it is." And so you see, there's that low invitation. It's one of we don't even really want this guy to be king. This low challenge. I'm not going to do anything for you except not lose the coin. And so there was a lot of that in the religious establishment. I think we just see it over and over with the people that rejected Jesus. And Brina's book called this the apathetic culture. I just don't care. I don't care about this relationship. I don't care about doing what God wants. It's completely outside of that. But then there's a second quadrant, moving straight over to the right. This would be one that senses a high invitation, a high sense of belonging with Jesus, but very low challenge. And Breen argued, I think with some accuracy, that's typically a lot of what we find in our churches. And really it's something in the missional communities, because the missional community is going out and trying to reach out to lost people, trying to be Jesus to them. And so we don't come in saying first thing, well, you can't be living with that woman. She's not your wife. We come in, and you don't come in and say, man, your big problem is those drugs. We come in and try to love and to reach out and that kind of thing. But really, there's a sense of it that even in our assemblies, right, that someone can make a very strong challenge to us, but we really have the option to not do anything with it, right? And we talk about having seeker assemblies, right? We want a seeker to be able to come in here and not feel too threatened, right? And for it to kind of go easy with them like that. Or even our small groups. There's a sense, you know, we've talked about here that one thing that we need is small groups, because in those we get to know people better. But typically we think of a small group as a place where you feel pretty safe, right? You don't want to invite your friend to come into something and have somebody jump all over them, right? You want it to be a place where they feel safe. And so we work to create kind of a comfortable environment. One that's kind of like some people have called a client provider, right? There's somebody that does the stuff for you, and I come in and I feel comfortable and I don't feel threatened. And Brink called that the chaplaincy quadrant, the cozy culture. And it's needed. We've got to have things like that. We've got to have places where people can feel safe and people can start getting involved with us and start getting to know Jesus. But then if I move back up catty corner to that, in the top left corner, and this is one that surprised me. I'd never really thought about it that much. He talked about people that feel a high challenge but low invitation. And what he was saying was, if you have this cozy culture down in the bottom, then it's probably because there's a few people that are working really, really hard to provide all those things. We talk about the 20% of the people doing 80% of the work, kind of thing that we've heard about. And so there's people that work really hard, and it's almost like it made me think in a sense of Martha, you remember? That Mary said, Jesus is here. Man, I got to sit down at his feet. And Martha's thinking, sister, there is so much to do. And she was always busy about doing all of those things. And so Breen talked about this stressful quadrant of the Marthas that are always trying to do everything. And he asked the question, he said, you know, Jesus called us also to rest. And God, when he created the heavens and the earth, he said, you know, the seventh day, we're not doing anything. And so Breen asked the question, he says, how many people actually pull out their day timer and schedule their rest first? Because God thought it was important enough that he said, hey, the seventh day, go ahead and mark it. And when you get done, there's other. And so he talked about, how do we have rest today? How do we set a time for that? And so Jesus in this thing, come all, to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest, Martha. And so he talks about the importance then of trying to find a balance that has this high invitation. And that's what Breen has called a discipling quadrant, or an empowered culture, one that finds rest in Jesus, but one that feels this sense of responsibility and growing and changing. I remember, and many of you may remember too, is in the late 80s, there were a lot of scandals of these televangelists. You remember Jim Baker and Jimmy Swaggart and all these guys that were... they were pointing fingers about how much better they were than somebody else, and then turns out that they were having these horrible problems in morally in their own lives. The fellows that were involved in sexual relationships with women who weren't their wives or with men. And I remember back about that time, I read an article where someone asked, what's his name, Billy Graham, if he thought something like that would ever happen to him. And Graham's response was, I have a group of about, I think he said, 5 or 6 guys, and we share absolutely everything together. We share anything that's tempting us, and we pray about it. And I thought, wow, I guess that would help, wouldn't it? Something that was so desperately missing in the lives of some of these other fellas. And of course, we can look back here 30 years later on Graham's life and see that was something that really blessed him and kept him straight. And so we have this idea then of this group that feels high invitation of belonging and a high sense of challenge of who we're going to be, and we're going to struggle together, and we're going to get there. And I thought he had some really good things to say there. Then something that they mention, if we're going to, and what they do, I guess I should say, in this quadrant, they have something that they call huddles, where they just get together and they try to share with each other what's happened in your life, and what do you think that God is calling you to out of that? And how can we encourage you or help you to respond the way you think God is asking you to? Those kinds of things, where they get in this culture that helps us be accountable to each other. And they talked about, you know, if we're going to be like that, if we're going to work toward being like that, we're going to have to expect some failures. But as they've said, they just keep working for low control, high accountability. So as to close us today, I'd like for us to spend a little time thinking about this question. What would be your salt and light obituary? Right at the beginning in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, you're salt of the earth, but if salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It's not for good for anything but thrown out on the road. And so I'd like for you to spend a little time in thinking about how our enemy would take you out, rendering you unable to serve your family, your community. Maybe it would be pride. Maybe it would be a sense that I've been slighted, that I haven't been respected. Maybe it would be some addiction. Whatever it would be, think for a moment about that obituary, looking back and saying, this is where it went wrong. And as you've done that, then to think maybe about what Breen's been talking about, I suppose, what difference could a culture of taking Jesus' yoke, that invitation and the challenge that you're going to learn, would that make? Kind of the Billy Graham scenario. What difference would that kind of relationship make? And then we'll be done. Think about these things.